You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 187. Today's episode is a long-awaited one. I interview my mom about growing up in New Orleans, surviving hurricanes, raising kids, and now having grandchildren that are New Orleanians. The last show was all about rugby in New Orleans. I knew very little about the topic, and I learned a lot. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. I think you'll enjoy it. Before we jump in, let me talk about the people that make this show possible. The support comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection, the city's premier history museum located at 520 Royal Street in the heart of the quarter. Check out their online publication called First Draft. It's a combination blog and online exhibition space at hnoc.org/firstdraft. Through November 5th, 2023, check out their exhibit about the women's right to vote, titled Yet She Is Advancing, New Orleans Women and the Right to Vote, 1878 to 1970. We actually did an episode with them about this exhibit just a couple episodes back, so you might want to check it out. But the long and the short of it is that while the 19th Amendment granted American women the right to vote in 1920, Louisiana laws effectively disenfranchised black women. As many white women began going to the polls and increasing their political participation, African American women continued to fight for access to the ballot. From paying poll taxes to organizing voter registration drives, black women challenged their status as second-class citizens up to and through the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. This exhibit tells a decades-long story through objects, images, documents, and interactive displays, and through the words of the women who for nearly 100 years persisted in their struggle to obtain the vote. As always, the Historic New Orleans Collection is free, and it shouldn't be missed. Go to hnoc.org/visit to plan your trip. Longtime listeners probably remember the crew over at Two Chicks Walking Tours. They operate intentionally small public tours of a maximum of 14 guests. So the city allows up to 28 people per tour, but they intentionally only go to half that size. What that means is that you're guaranteed to have a small, intimate experience when you go. Their tours are focused on the Garden District and French Quarter neighborhoods. Another thing that Two Chicks does is they also produce private curated walks. So if there's something specific you're interested in, you can work with them and they'll design a tour for you, and it can be for just one person or up to groups as big as 200 when called upon. The team is female-led, but they do have one rooster strutting around, and there are tour guides from before the lockdown still on staff. Find out more at twochickswalkingtours.com, and we'll put a link in the show notes. Last up before we jump into today's topic is James Cullen Photography. If you own a copy of my book, The Beyond Bourbon Street Travel Guide to New Orleans, you've seen the work of James Cullen of Accidental Cajun Photography. Whether it's portraits, events, weddings, or lifestyle or photojournalism, Accidental Cajun Photography provides quality and value. One of the things I think that sets James apart is his ability to capture experiences through the faces of people that he photographs. You can see it in our Facebook group. You can certainly see it at his own work at accidentalcajun.com. And you can see it in the book. James did about 40 or 50% of the work in the book. And so each item that he did has his name on it. So you can check that out. James also offers photography instruction and sells his fine art prints at theaccidentalcajun.com. For inquiries, email James at accidentalcajun@gmail.com. Now let's jump into today's topic. I interviewed my dad way back in episode 6 about the history of the po' boy. However, I've never interviewed my mom. After many requests, that day is finally here. So welcome to the show, Jan Bologna, better known as Mom. Hi, Mom. How are you?
I'm great, Mark. Thanks for having me. It's a delight and very humbling that you want to interview me, your mom.
Well, it's only 7 years late, but, you know, that's okay. Let's talk a little bit about your background first. So you were born in 1950. You grew up in New Orleans. You've been a New Orleanian your entire life. What was it like growing up in New Orleans?
Well, it was vastly different than it is today. And I think the reason being is back then you didn't have all of the social media and all the connections that you have today. The other thing is, remember, it's the 50s. So most moms were stay-at-home moms, which meant in our area, there were lots of kids all the times, lots of big families who all lived very close to each other. So that is one real difference from today, where many women are working moms, they're not home. Communities are more spread out than they used to be in terms of that. And I had five sisters. So we were kind of the house where people wanted to come because there was always something going on. And it seemed to me that childhood was a lot less encumbered by all the outside things, meaning we had to invent our own toys, our own games. We had China ball fights. We had penny parties. We had tag. We had all those things that the kids today sometimes miss out on. So I do see that as a big difference.
Another thing that is, well, not unique to you, but unique in our family, is that you lived through both Hurricanes Betsy and Katrina. So what was that like, and how were they similar and different?
Well, when Betsy struck New Orleans, I was 15 years old, and we lived in Gentilly, sort of for people's perspective. If you know where 610 is, and then the railroad track just beyond that, we lived between that. They were just excavating for the interstate bypass, and so there were no houses there, but where we lived, there were. Our house was razed. And as far as we knew, the hurricane was vicious. The house shifted on its foundation. It was a small raised house. And so that was very terrifying. However, we all went to bed thinking it was over. And in the middle of the night, I got up and there was water on the floor, which was coming up through the heater in the floor. And so we realized in short order that the city must be flooded, which was not truth. But again, we had no way of communicating with people. So that's what we thought. And quickly the water rose to where it was chest high on me, which I was tall, 5'8", 5'10 at the time. So in a raised house, that was significant water. What happened was, not really sure, I think a levee gave down in St. Bernard and it just flowed into the area where we lived. So while we thought the whole city was underwater, it was very isolated. So I'll stop at that moment about Betsy. For Katrina, the levee broke 10 doors from our house and flooded the entire neighborhood, as did the other levees that broke and flooded the entire city. So where we were isolated, Katrina was a complete failure in the city. Everything was flooded. So back to Betsy. So we, with the boys down the street who had a pirogue or had a little boat, actually got us to the neighborhood school. And when I say us, two sisters and myself and two teenage boys, and we literally broke into the neighborhood school because we knew the school. It was Stuart R. Bradley. And we went in and we were able to know where the nurse's office was and know where the food was and gather that. And in short order, some of our parents came. Well, before it was over, I want to say there was probably 300 people there on the second story when the army came along in their amphibious ducks and said we had to leave because it wasn't a shelter. So we did. We managed to make our way to a sister's home who did not flood. So there's a lot of difference in that when you're a teenager, it was almost an adventure, as sick as that sounds. It was almost an adventure that we were put through to go through that. And my two older sisters, who were just older than me, maybe 17 and 18, the three of us were charged with going back to clean out the house. Mm. My dad couldn't handle it. So we returned, and the three of us, along with one boyfriend, literally gutted the 900-foot square foot house after Betsy and put it all on the street. We lived elsewhere for 9 months till the house was renovated. Katrina, I don't know if Mark's ever broached this before, but in Katrina, my husband and I lost our family home where the kids grew up. We lost our business, which was Teddy's Grill. It was underwater also. And we also lost the rental property we had in the east. The roof blew off. So it was a clean sweep where all of a sudden we found ourselves 55 years old with no income, no job, and dreams of our kids and raising grandchildren in the home they grew up were all shattered. We'll say the difference was we had each other. Vince and I and the kids all worked through this together, and that was an immense difference. And it was so complete, though, that in some way that was consoling and both disarming, that it was so complete for this city.
Yeah, yeah. So you mentioned that Katrina, the levee broke. What you didn't mention is that our house backed up against the levee. So we had a yard, and Correct. Then we had a levee. And so when Mom says 10 houses down, it was literally in the backyard, you know, 75 yards probably about from the our backyard to where the levee broke. But behind our house physically was the levee. And in recent years, they had put, and this was part of the reason for the failure, they had put, driven into the ground steel, I guess, feet. Steel spikes, and then, or steel wall, and then on top of it, they put a concrete berm. And truthfully, had they not done that, probably the levee would have been all right. But it turns out that that was a structural defect that the Army Corps of Engineers did. So when Mom talks about flooding the house, it was really, really close because we grew up with that levee in our backyard.
Mm-hmm. Well, the levee didn't really fail. It was a berm that formed underneath. It eroded because, you know, we were on reclaimed land in most of New Orleans, swampland. And so it just created a berm underneath. And the way we knew that is the person's house that was in front of it, his tool shed raised up out of the ground and sat atop this berm that had been formed or a rise. So that's how we knew that it didn't overtop the levee. The levee collapsed. And, you know, those kinds of things were really difficult to accept because we thought we were protected and we weren't. But you know what? God is good. And we moved on and it was not easy. Our adult children, Mark included, all came home to help us gut the restaurant and go through the house and find things that were important to us. And that's what we did. So there was a vast difference between the two in the outcome. Betsy, everybody in the neighborhood, except for us, pretty much washed their walls and moved back in, which till this day I think is bizarre, right, considering what was in the water. My family, on the other hand, given the state with my mom and dad, they felt incapable of doing that. And so we literally had somebody come in and just paddle over the mess, you know. So it was just a crazier time. Whereas move forward to Katrina, oh my goodness, you had the DEQ and you had all these agencies telling you what was safe and what wasn't. So a lot of different protocols after Katrina than what we went through as teenagers in Betsy.
Yeah, well, I think about all the mold when we came back after Katrina and how much of that was that way in Betsy. Yeah. You guys weren't gone as long. I mean, you were gone from the house for a long time. Mm-hmm. But in Katrina, everyone was out of the city for 6 weeks. So in that sense, it was different too. So it didn't sit, the water didn't sit as long mm-hmm. as it did in Katrina. But still, you wonder about that, right? You know?
Yeah, you do. And I was going to say one little thing flashed through my mind, which is kind of an aside. The day after we evacuated from Betsy, my dad got somebody with a speedboat to take us back to see what we could salvage. And of the six girls, I was like daddy's boy because, you know, I would go along with all his fixing up things and pranks. And so I went back with him, and I think one of my other sisters was there. And we literally rode the boat over the top of my sister's car and put a gash in it. So, you know, it's like, you think of that. And then when we jumped out to go in the house, it was very eerie because you got to remember, we were dry land to whatever was in the water. So you can just imagine what that was. So it was just really interesting. And then the other thing was the doors were open because when you have the force of water, once you open a door, you don't close it. So things had floated all over the house and all of that. Katrina, oh, we had hermetically sealed the house before we evacuated. So when we went back, things were in their rooms, but totally turned upside down and all over.
Yeah, I remember looking for the dining room table and mm-hmm. then realizing we were standing on the dining room table because it had flipped over.
Yeah.
Coincidentally, the next podcast episode that I'm doing is with Richard Campanella about a book he has about 300 years of draining the city of New Orleans. And he talks, and I'm sure we'll get into it with Richard, he talks a good bit about Katrina. And in fact, he talks about the failure at the London Avenue Canal, which is a canal my mom's talking about, and the fact that exactly what you're describing, what happened was that the corrugated steel gave way and it pushed water under it. And what it did was it dug up thousands of years of sand. It essentially instantly elevated or covered everything around it. And so when Mom talked about the shed across the street, that's what happened. All this, and he's going to use a different word than I would, but all of this thousand-year-old material got pushed up, and essentially everything that had subsided in that one spot got pushed back up in one fell swoop.
Well, we all of a sudden had a sandy front lawn, like beachfront property, and it's like right. It all had all been that. Green. It was all from that.
Right. So let's shift topics to a brighter subject. You and Dad got married young and you owned a business. So what was that like?
Interesting. We got married in April of 69. And by November of 69, the owner of Teddy's at the time approached my husband. My husband was a manager there. Did he want to buy it? And so immediately he said yes and came home and told me. And I was terrified. It's like, first off, how are we going to do this? I mean, that's just an impossibility with two 19-year-olds who own zero. But again, you know, My husband's very persistent, and he found a way to have someone help us, co-sign for us. And hence, on January 2nd of 1970, we were owners of a restaurant. It was difficult because we didn't know anything about running a business, let alone a restaurant on our own. So it really was learn as you go. And sometimes the learning curve was very difficult, very difficult. Cost us financially, spiritually, mentally, physically, but we survived it because we learned. In the midst of that, 9 months after we bought the restaurant.
9 months and 2 weeks, to be
Mark
exact.
Mark was born. So not only did we have our restaurant, and we were married a year by the time we were 20, but we also had a baby. So those early years were tough going because we had lots of responsibilities. It was interesting, though, because from the get-go, to be able to serve the citizens of New Orleans in that manner had always been incredible. There are so many interesting stories that walk through that door every day, and so many interesting people. And to give them something that we prepared was wonderful. And Mark actually was in the restaurant from pre-birth all the way up till he was a toddler, because I had to work in the restaurant with my husband, so he was down there with us. Then it got to be a bit much, but it was real interesting because the other thing is my husband didn't know how to cook in the early days. So every time I made something good at home, his eyes would flash and he'd say, "Can you make this for like 60 people?" And I'm like, "Okay." So I would make the main thing at home, the main dish, and then Mark and I would get in the car and we would drive it to the restaurant. And finally, when the second child came along, I told him he had to learn how to cook because it was just now too hard. But it was interesting in the early days to try to figure out not only a business, but a marriage and a family. And trying to balance that was what we spent almost all of our life trying to do. Because if any of you are in business, you know how difficult that can be. The kids were brought to the restaurant quite a bit so they could see their dad. And then once the children were all in school, I worked the hours they were in school with him. And that stood until Katrina. So it was fun. It was interesting. We do miss the people and we do miss our own food.
But, yeah, definitely.
But the grandkids will say, "Too bad you don't have it. We could have all the French fries." And we said, "Yes, but if we had it, that's the only place you'd see us."
Yeah, and I have a question about that in a minute. I'll get to mm-hmm. that. But what do you think? This is sort of a general open-ended question, but what do you think about the city now? Now, you know, 20 years almost after Katrina and all that's happened. What's your observation about the city today?
Well, sometimes it's difficult because I have very mixed emotions. It's like I'm so thrilled when I see some of the progress, the medical centers, all those things coming up, the up-and-coming businesses. But on the other side, we've never corrected the problems with being able to provide our citizens with good infrastructure or good police work. And there are good policemen, I'm not saying that, but consistently good leadership to really have us move forward the way we should have done. I mean, after Katrina, as sad as that was a golden opportunity to have a clean sweep of the way old things were done and venture into new ideas on water systems, on the delivery of our services, on all those things. And I don't know, I'm not a political person, but it seems to me the balls were dropped and people were allowed to come back willy-nilly without things that would really benefit their growth in the long run. And that's been hard to watch, to see how many people we know have struggled with that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yet on the other side, it's wonderful. I still love the city, like Mark. I still have a passion for all things New Orleans. It's wonderful. The food, the people are indescribably good. The basic person here is wonderful, and that goes across all walks of life. It's just a few bad apples causing a lot of issues. And, you know, for that, you know, you feel really bad about, but do I have a problem coming here? Absolutely not. Yes, we did move an hour out of the city, but that was for our own well-being in the sense of financial and but we're an hour away. We're here often because of Mark and Marie and the girls,
day,
you know? So it's not like that inhibits us from enjoying the city.
So my questions are disjointed. And the reason for that is because I have listener questions that are going to fill in some of the gaps. But before we get to those, one of the things that is very different than had Katrina not happened. Had Katrina not happened, in all likelihood, you guys would still have the restaurant and Dad would still be working 70, 80 hours a week.
Sure.
The other thing is, at that time, you had two grandkids who live in Texas. Now you had one grandchild, actually, that lived in Texas. Now there's two there. And now you have six grandkids, including our twins. And you have another set of grandkids that are twins that live near Atlanta. But what is it like having grandkids that are New Orleanians?
Well, for me personally, it's a joy. I just love when they say all things New Orleans. Like some of the things they'll tell us that they enjoy, going to the festivals or getting beignets or Mardi Gras. It's really wonderful. It's sort of like my upbringing is being passed on to them. It was passed on to our children. The love of New Orleans and all things New Orleans. The people and the, I think it's joie de vivre and the, like Livy says, les le bon temps roulet, all those things, but just the goodness. And it's a joy to have the kids here, and especially nice to have kids close by that we can pass on to them what little bit of knowledge we have about the city and things we did growing up, dating, getting married. Of course, Sophie thinks we got married too young, but you know, it's still fun to pass all those things on to kids who live right here. And we can point out things to them that we did or where we went. It's really a joy. And two of the other four grandchildren, although they were not born here and have never lived here, are very New Orleanian because of their mom. She insists that they know everything. The other two have been a little bit more removed. They're in Dallas, and they really don't have the same sentiment or experience. But that's okay.
Yeah, I think some of that is because they're the oldest two, and they were not as young or not. Five of the six were not born at the time of Katrina, but they are the oldest two, and so I think that they got older and got involved in activities, and so it made it harder to come back as often. Whereas my sister's twins are a year and a half younger than our twins, and so, you know, they've come back more. So now the reason that the questions were disjointed, Mom, is I have questions from two groups. One are patrons. And so a patron is somebody that contributes a little bit of money or sometimes a lot of money each month to help support the work that I do. So we ask them for questions, and you haven't seen those because you're not in that group. I won't let you pay to be in that group. and so listeners know when I do a Q&A, I don't read the questions, but this time I did read them, and the questions I asked you first were kind of fitting around the questions that I knew were coming. So here goes. I'm going to just hit you with these in the order they were written to me.
Should I be scared?
only of one or two, I think.
Okay.
So first up, from Vanessa Zamora, what was your favorite thing about raising kids in New Orleans?
The favorite thing would be so many things to take them to experience that weren't just like jumping on a trampoline or going to, there were so many things. I mean, I can remember taking them to the French Quarter with my mom and taking them around and telling them about the wrought iron and the Cabildo. I can remember taking them to the lakefront when there'd be different things sponsored out there, or just to have a picnic by Mardi Gras Fountain. I guess it was the availability to have really good family fun time without a lot of expense, but it was also educational, historical. Uh-huh. It wasn't the run-of-the-mill things. It
could be different. Uniquely New Orleans things.
Uniquely New Orleans. Ride the ferry boat, ride the streetcar, get beignets. Uh-huh. You know, all simple activities, yet they were so entrenched in our culture here. And I think that was a lot of fun. I mean, I don't know what their individual memories are, but we were able to do some of that. And even some things that were a little bit more benign, like there was a skating rink out at the Plaza shopping mall out in New Orleans East, and we used to be able, on a family on a budget with three little kids, we were able to go out there and buy them hot dogs, and they were thrilled to watch. And I thought that was unique and fun because we don't have ice skating rinks in New Orleans,
right?
You know, so while they never skated, they just were enamored of watching other people do that. So I would think that things that are aside from that, very traditional New Orleans things, was a joy to be able to share with the children.
Yep. I think so. We've actually done an episode called, I think it's called 52 Free or Nearly Free Things to Do in New Orleans. And probably, well, one, there's way more than 52, because you know me, I'm not good with rule following, even if I set the rules. But something like 90% of them are things that you can't do in any other city. Mm-hmm. And I think that gets to it. It was the same way when we were kids. You know, so many things that we take for granted here are not only inexpensive, but are unique to the city.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we did get to do a lot of that growing up. We got to do a lot of that with Mama, your mom, and with you. She loved the city, and they were poor, and yet we didn't want for doing lots of things. I think about right here, we have a painting that Mom did of a scene in City Park, and we spent many hours climbing over those WPA era bridges, you know, it doesn't cost anything. And even today, we take our kids to that very same spot, buy beignets, which, you know, back then were a nickel or 15 cents, maybe 25 cents.
About that.
Yeah. Now it's $3.15.
But still worth
40
it.
Years, still pretty cheap, you know, when you think about that.
But I think if you look at your surroundings and take advantage of the things that are to your culture or indigenous to the area, there's so much there to do, and you can repeat that with generations.
Yes. Where I would slightly disagree with you is having lived in a bunch of different places. Every place has things that are uniquely theirs. No place that I've lived has as much that is uniquely theirs as New Orleans does. At least no place that I've lived.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. And I left every question in. So Cliff Hochberg, and I actually got to meet Cliff. He was here for a jazz band camp this last week, which was pretty neat. But Cliff asks, what was it like raising Mark while spending so much time in the family restaurant business? Any interesting story come to mind about Mark growing up in that family business?
Uh-oh. Well, first off, Mark wasn't alone for too long. But when he was 23 months old, we had another child. And then when he was just five, we had another child. But he did have the advantage of being the first down there. It was interesting because, of course, when he was a baby, he was precious. He's not going to want me to say that, but he was absolutely adorable. And, of course, people fawned over him. So I think he probably enjoyed the limelight a bit when he was little. As he grew, he was given tasks to do down there. I mean, we didn't believe in child labor, but at the same time, when you own a family restaurant, people have to come with you and they have to do different chores and things. So I think it was, how is that raising him in the restaurant?
Mm-hmm.
It was okay. And then I think once the kids went to school, when they were young, of course, I worked. After school, I was home with them. But as they got to be teenagers, it was a built-in summer job, which could work around their schedules, like it or not. I mean, they could if they had other activities. So I think the beauty there was he got to see what his dad did and work with his dad and me sometimes, because during the summers, I had to be home a lot. But I think it was fine experience. Now, the funny thing is, Mark was more of an innovator. Like, Mark wanted to do things, I don't want to say differently, but he would have been more forward thinking than we were, you know, and he really enjoyed working with the customers and being right in the front doing the food and all. I think I have that right.
Mm-hmm.
He really enjoyed that. And he also, at a very early age, wanted to take some authority. So I can remember at 16, he wanted to fire an employee and we had to kind of have a talk with him because that would have been really awkward. But yeah, he had a great business mind and a great sense with the customers. And it was fun to have him there. It wasn't a problem. You know, I mean, I think you go through the different levels of teenage angst and things like that. So at times you have to talk them down. But I think it was a fine experience. I don't know the other part of the question.
No, you got it. What was it like raising Mark while spending so much time in the family business? You know, essentially I was there, you know, in a playpen in the back, you know, when I was tiny. I think two, many memories stand out for me. One, I will correct you slightly. The rule was when you were 11, you had to go to work at the restaurant. Not a teenager, 11. And by the time I was in high school, I was working 30 hours a week. By the time I was a senior, I was working pretty much 40 hours a week, as well as going to school. But two things that jump out to me. One, I remember we were at the restaurant all the time. So especially me, studying was done at the restaurant. So I can remember we had these big chest freezers in the back of the kitchen, and that's where I would do my reading, or we would crawl up in the storeroom. It had three or four rows, sort of like bunk beds, but it was full of rice and beans and cans of things and all the supplies for the restaurant, crawling up there to do homework because we were there so much. So, you know, that was very ordinary to me, but it's not an ordinary thing. And then the second, and this is more a product of the 70s, you would never do what I'm about to say today, but we had a station wagon and the French market was really an operating produce market. There was no Sam's or Costco. And so you would go several times a week and Mom usually went to pick up fresh things, whether it was onions or tomatoes or lettuce or cabbage or potatoes or whatever it was. And they would load that in the back of the station wagon. And then we would be allowed to crawl into the little crawl space between the ceiling of the roof of the car and on top of all those sacks of vegetables and ride back to the restaurant, which was just a couple of miles, but still ride back kind of sandwiched in between the fresh produce and the top of the restaurant. And I can remember doing that, if I have it right, even before we would go to school. So on the way to school, or maybe I have that a little confused, but we were little.
That I would disagree with you because I really couldn't go down there before school because that would have messed up the school schedule.
So maybe it was summer, I'm thinking.
But yeah, it could have been summer. But I do remember the many, many days I took the three kids down to the market with a baby on the hip and two little ones. And oh, I'd have the men with the dollies following me, sometimes all the way to Esplanade, because there was no parking.
Right.
So yeah, I have many memories of that. And then of course the kids benefited in a way from that, that they were given apples or whatever the people had at the time. So as a mom looking back, it was difficult to know that the kids had to be there so much. But at the same time, that was our livelihood. That's what we chose to be able to afford, to have the children, raise them, send them to Catholic school, and so on and so forth. So I don't think the exposure was a bad one.
I think they learned a lot.
And in a lot of ways, it was a lot of fun. And of course, a lot of the customers, I mean, till this day, if we run into them, how were the kids? Which the kids are not kids. But, you know, so it's interesting because when you raise your children in the public, everybody knows them. I mean, they used to bring them birthday gifts and Christmas gifts and all of that. So it was a good thing in that sense.
Yeah, well, I think like now the market, as we knew it, doesn't really exist. Mm-hmm. And so that was a really great New Orleans. It was a lot of fun. I mean, I remember being handed whatever they had, like you said, an apple or a banana or grapes or whatever. But the vendors were these individual stalls. The closest thing I can think of is if you've been to Europe and you've been to fresh markets, it was like that, except there was one stall there was a place called Dixie Tomatoes, for instance. That's all they sold was tomatoes. And then you would go next door and there was a place that sold, I think, onions and cabbage and potatoes, you know, and so you would walk literally down the stalls with a guy with a, like you said, with a cart behind you, like loading up each of the things you bought. And we would do that a couple of days a week. That was, you know, that was how you get fresh food.
At least back then, there were a lot more small business people, small vendors, where you could
certainly
we were in business for 36 years. So certainly toward the end of that, it was more dealing with the bigger entities that handled all your groceries, which is not a bad thing. But at the same time, you kind of missed that individual. They knew us, you know, and you missed that side of it, being able to deal one-on-one.
Right. Because it was a very specific thing. Again, mm-hmm. there was a guy that sold tomatoes and only tomatoes. And then you go to the next thing. And when the Cisco's and Conoco's and then Sam's and Costco came along, it really cleared all that out. So that doesn't exist. I mean, the closest thing today would be if you go to a farmer's market, but you have to think of a farmer's market on steroids, like a much bigger mm-hmm. version of that, because it wasn't just us. It was all businesses, all restaurants doing the same thing, mm-hmm. right? Going a couple days a week to pick up fresh produce or seafood or whatever it might have been. All right. So, you know, you talk about living in the public life. It's a little bit like that with the podcast. People know a lot more about, although I'm somewhat guarded, I'm not as guarded as I think I am. People come up and meet me and they know an awful lot about me and I don't know, you know, much about them. And this question kind of gets to that because I don't remember talking about this, but clearly Jeff Singer knows that I've talked about it. Jeff Singer says, how is life different living on the North Shore compared to the city?
Hmm.
So obviously I must have mentioned that you live on the North Shore.
I think that was a little bone of contention for our dear son Mark at one point, because my husband and I were both born and raised in the city. And of course the kids were, and we dearly loved it. Our decision to move to the North Shore is a little corny and a little not. One was we wanted to be above sea level, which is crazy, but we did. And then, truthfully, there was so much wrong or broken at the time we had to make the decision.
Right.
It's like it made sense to us for the dollars we had and the position we were in to go north. Knowing that, we have no qualms about driving the causeway even a couple of times a day. That doesn't bother us. Living on the North Shore is a different experience. There's many people that have been displaced from New Orleans, but I got to tell you, when we first moved over there, people would say, oh, you're new here. Where are you from? And we'd say, from New Orleans. And they would get this look and say, whoa, you're from the other side, as though we had, you know, something wrong. But the deal was, is that their populations increased because uh-huh. more people came over. It's lovely living over there, but it's also lovely knowing the city is in close proximity. So we have, it's a little different quality of life because their services are services. Mm-hmm. You pay your taxes, you have services. The neighborhoods are, you know, I could walk at midnight. It doesn't really matter. It's more of a small town feel. It's like Mayberry, yet you're very close to everything you could want in the city. So that's different altogether. And of course, you're asking me a question that also is predicated on age, because if we were there with young kids, it probably would not be, it'd be a little bit more of an adjustment. You know, when we lived in the city with kids, we knew other kids, we knew other families. Now we're older, and so it's okay for us not to have, you know, 15 children living close by and all those things. And shopping isn't, it's close, it's not extremely close. I mean, it's not like walking distance or anything like that. And mass transit doesn't exist. Where I grew up on mass transit, my parents didn't own a car. So that's different two generations back. So yes, but it's lovely. I love living there, but I also enjoy things in the city.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things that you guys do differently is that you do come to the city a lot, you know, several times a week and most weeks, whether that's to come see us or for you guys still own property in the city or whether it's to socialize. Mm-hmm. You know, you're in the city a lot, whereas a lot of people move across the lake and see it as this giant chasm, kind of like you mentioned, people were treated you like and don't ever come into the city.
Correct.
You know, you guys come in for Mardi Gras, you come in for events, you come in to go out to dinner, you know, see friends, all that stuff. So I think that's a little different than some people go or grow up on that side of the lake and really don't
that's
come
wonderful.
Across
no.
much. So,
but there's a shift in mentality, because I will say, when we lived in the city before Katrina and we had friends on the North Shore, we would say to each other, oh gosh, that's a whole day's trip. Now that we live over there, we realize that bridge is 23 minutes to cross it doing the speed limit. So it's not any more than if you traveling from Kenner to downtown.
Right. So well, and I think it's just a sense of when you're in New Orleans, everything is close, right? Mm-hmm. So my brother lives near Dallas and my sister lives near Atlanta. So 45 minutes to go somewhere is nothing. You know, I lived in Houston for a long time. I lived in the D.C. area. 45 minutes is nothing. But in New Orleans, 45 minutes is you can get clear across town on surface streets in 45 minutes.
Right.
And not only that, you don't do it because you're aggravated that you'd have to go that far. There's no reason to go that far, right? Unless you're going to see somebody.
That's a different mentality.
Right. The one thing I'll tag on to that is you mentioned my hesitation. So when Marie and I moved back with the kids were 10 weeks old, and it was really important to me to live in the city. So we are now the last of the immediate Bologna family. I have a very large extended family, but the Bologna's on my dad's side, and the Vickner's on my mom's side. We're the last ones to live in the city. Mm-hmm. And that was really important to me. There are days when I think life would be easier if we had moved to, say, Old Metairie or across the lake. But we chose very specifically to, if we were going to raise the kids as New Orleanians, we were going to live in New Orleans. Again, I question that some days when life is a little tough, but particularly once my parents moved across the North Shore, it was important to me to have family presence in the city, and I took that upon myself, Marie and I, to do that.
But I will say, when they made that decision, we were elated because, of course, it would mean grandchildren here, but we also made them a promise that we would be here, and we did. We came every day and spoiled the girls, and so I think it's a mindset for most people. You just got to... If you live across the lake, you have to be willing to come into the city if you have family and all here.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, so Melissa Roberson Lang asks, what has it been like to witness the growth and many changes to the city over the years? Have you ever been tempted to leave Louisiana because of the frequent storms and or political / social climate?
Never. Never been tempted.
Yeah, I could have answered that for you.
Yeah, never have we considered leaving Louisiana. I will say that after Katrina, all three of our adult children lived out of state, including Mark, and we were asked numerous times, which child will you go live near? Well, first off, much to the chagrin of our youngest son, we do not play favorites. So we would not have chosen to live by one over the other, especially since we have no need to do that. And the second thing was, we, like Mark said, we still own property here, and it's like we were willing to move out of the city proper. We weren't willing to give up. And so that's a difference. You know, it's like we weren't willing to do that. So it's like that never crossed our minds. Yes, there were days when we wanted to just rip our hair out at the roots over the problems that existed. For instance, like no gas or electricity on Franklin Avenue for a full year where our business had been. But, you know, nonetheless, we wanted to stay close. So that was never an option. That wasn't even a thought.
What's it been like to witness the growth and changes to the city over the years?
Some I really like, some I really don't. You know, it's real simple. Makes me sad to see like the neighborhood where I was a child just be really deteriorated, and the streets are so bad. You can't drive but, 5 or 10 miles an hour down it.
Yeah.
That's sad. And yet 3 blocks away is a gorgeous new school, and it's beautiful. I like some of the things they've done. Like I think it's really been nice to see the development on Canal Street of all the, I guess it's the veterans complex of all the hospitals and all of that.
Sure.
That's beautiful. That's a good progression. So I would say some of the change I really like. Some I don't. I have to say I don't particularly care right now for what they're doing with some of the schools, you know, that kind of thing. That's not been a good thing.
And so for background there, for people that don't know, essentially after Katrina, New Orleans converted to an effectively 100% charter school program. So there is no public school system in the sense that there is in other communities. It's all charter school. And those tend to be run by for-profit organizations. So there's a, I don't know, you can jump in, but there's a lack of community, even in the way they're mm-hmm. named. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't have sort of mascots. They don't have an identity. Now, maybe some people would disagree with me, but it feels that way on the whole compared to where it was. Now, don't get me wrong. The school system was broken before Katrina, but I don't think that this experiment has worked anywhere near as well as people had hoped or maybe thought it would.
And of course, my experience of that is hearsay, because, or stories in the newspaper or whatever, because of course we don't have children in those systems and we don't have children ourselves that have to use those systems. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing I really had hoped for great improvement, and it, in my eyes, most have not improved. I like the fact that streetcars once again have become a big thing. Yeah. I really like that. And I think, if I'm not wrong, they've added one since Katrina, the one down Carrollton.
So they've added a couple, actually. They've added the Carrollton extension of the Canal Street line. We call it the Red Streetcar.
Right.
And then they have put back a portion of the Rampart, the Desire Streetcar line.
That's true. Right. I forgot about that. But that's a wonderful thing to me, because that's really part, I mean, that goes back to our heart, because our first date was on the streetcars the last time they ran on Canal Street back in 1964. Yeah. So that's that. And of course, that was a childhood thing with the kids riding the streetcar.
Yeah.
So that, I think, has been wonderful that they're really trying to capitalize on that, which adds to the rapid transit, which I think, and I haven't rode on a bus, in a very long time, but that's how I grew up, either walk or rode a bus. So to think about all the people who can't have a car for affordability and all, to really improve that system to where it's reliable. And I don't know enough about it to say it's not, but it just seems to me when we're going into the city, I don't see as many buses and I do see people waiting. So you think, okay, that would be a big improvement. Mm-hmm. That would really help bring people back to the city.
I think they have made some improvements. In fact, our friends Jen and Chris are now a one-car family and they use the buses all the time. Mm-hmm. Actually.
Well, that's great. That's great to hear.
And there are more streetcar lines than there have been since the 60s. So they have added, because in addition to the two lines we talked about, they added a very short extension, but that goes from the bus stop past the Hyatt and the Superdome and then connects into the Rampart line, if I remember correctly. But the whole Rampart line, part of that is the old Desire streetcar line, and putting that back made a big difference. And you're starting to see it. And then you mentioned the two hospitals. You have LSU Medical Center, which took the place of the old Charity Hospital, and you have the VA Medical Center right next to each other on Canal Street. And those streetcars get a lot of traffic there. Mm-hmm. And so that's a good thing. All right. So the next two actually come from one of our cousins. So it comes from Susan Richmond Hall Craft.
Oh.
The first one, Susan says, what is the influence of any of your family's French culture on you versus the Italian culture that you married into?
Well, it was cooking.
Yeah, of course.
Because we were first married and I'd cook, I would say, you know, down here in the South, we call red sauce, red gravy. So I would do my version of red gravy and Mark's father would look at it and say, it tastes okay, but what is it? And I'd say it was red gravy and say, this doesn't look a thing like my mother's because, you know, we were chunkier and thinner and whatever it was. So I would say that was one really big thing. Mm-hmm. The other thing, I guess, is just my mom didn't speak English till she was like in second grade, as at least that's what we were told. And so I grew up with a lot of verbiage of French, but never knew it because they didn't want to teach us because then we wouldn't know what they were saying. So I think that was one influence. I can't say that it was particularly to one nationality or the other, but I think one thing that was just ingrained in me is hospitality. And that came from my mom, who was French and German. And as little as they had, you could never go there without being fed.
Mm-hmm.
And she worried about people not getting things, even if they were wealthy. It's like we'd take the bus to bring Jell-O to a wealthy aunt. But, you know, so it's like that ingrained of hospitality. Don't know if that's French or Italian, but, you know, that was one thing. As far as the Italians go, a lot more traditions came in. Well, let me backtrack to my mom. One tradition that was really there was absolute Catholicism and Mass on Sundays. And us Vickner girls were marched to church on Saturdays to go to confession every Saturday. Vickner girls didn't miss Saturdays. And that was very much in the French culture, the Catholic traditions. And so that Christmas Eve was a big deal to my mother. You know, then I marry into an Italian family who's like Cecil B. DeMille does any meal. It's like huge.
Right.
And they have traditions. And so we had to, over the years, adapt some of those. And the main one, and Mark has talked about this, maybe someday he'll do a whole cast on it, but St. Joseph's table, St. Joseph's tradition of the altars. In our case, it's a table, although it could easily be an altar because it's so big. Those traditions, I would say the way they influenced me is Italians, not unlike some other cultures, are very family oriented. So they were very much into, you know, trying to get together, trying to be together. So I'd say those were influences there, although they merged.
Yeah, well, and the other thing is, you were young when you married Dad, but you were friends with Dad's twin sister. So you were immersed in that at a very, very young age.
Yeah.
Middle school.
Just a little backstory on that. My parents decided when I was in fifth grade to switch me to a Catholic school because they were paying $4 a month for transportation for me to go to catechism at the Catholic school. And the tuition was $6. So they thought it would be a bargain to just send me. And when they did that, of course, you're an outcast when you're in sixth grade. And so my husband's twin sister befriended me and we became best friends. And that's how I got to know my eventual husband.
Right. So you were immersed in that big Italian family from a very, very young age.
It was intimidating. And it was intimidating till probably I was 50. And then I realized I don't need to be intimidated anymore.
Well, and over the years, we have often talked about that. We have a very large Italian family, lots and lots and lots of cousins. And when we were all dating age, it was intimidating for the girls or guys that would come to the family events, right? You'd come to an Easter dinner and there'd be 50 people, you know, or whatever it might be, really
big.
It had its way of weeding things out in its own way. So Susan asks also, and this could be a whole show, so you're going to have to pick a little bit here.
Okay.
Susan says, what are your favorites, restaurants, attractions, cultural in New Orleans, and any specific memories to share of any of them that could influence listeners to visit them? And I'm going to prompt you. One, of course, would be City Park.
Yes.
You know, we spend a ton of time there.
It's beautiful with the oak trees that dip down to the ground. I have pictures somewhere, if they survive Betsy and Katrina, of me as a little tiny girl in City Park with the same oak trees our kids climbed on. So that's beautiful memories there. And Dad and I dating would go there and do a little picnic lunch. And when we had young kids, we went there. So that's a mainstream through all of it. The other one is Mardi Gras. I have memories as a little girl. My mom would not go to Mardi Gras. So my dad would get us a ride because he didn't have a car. And they dropped us five girls and my dad off on Washington and St. Charles. And what I saw of Mardi Gras was knees because we couldn't, he couldn't pick us all
up. Before
parade
ladders.
So yeah, you know, so that's a constant stream. And then we were dating. It was wonderful to go to Mardi Gras. Our best friends, Dan and Carol, would go, the four of us, and would schlep all our food for the day. And as teenagers, it was awesome to just experience that. And then you go to having children. We have pictures of Mark in a little clown suit when he's three, maybe. And, you know, we go all the way back. And yes, we are the parents who took the kids to Mardi Gras always because it is a family event. And that is one that carries through to this day. We still enjoy it. Of course, I've been able to appease my husband. He was so tired of dragging kids and all. He's like, he's backed off a little bit, but he knows I love Rex. So we will never miss Rex as long as we're walking and able to get there. So yes, I'd say Mardi Gras, City Park. As far as eating goes, a couple of things we did are no longer there. So we used to go to the Beef Baron, which was a steak restaurant, which always held special memories for us because they had these little booths with curtains. So, you know, it was like highfalutin. And then the Blue Room for dinner was really a special memory for us.
At the Roosevelt Hotel.
At the Roosevelt Hotel. And I imagine it still is. I imagine you'd still have dinner there.
They have the Blue Room. They rarely open it, so it's not an open restaurant. There's there's Dominica there now.
So that's different.
But the Sazerac Bar is open there as well, which is adjacent to what would have been the Blue Room when you went.
Okay, well, I didn't know that. But Then the other thing that I think we've enjoyed and we've told other people to go to, and I'm sure Mark has, is Preservation Hall. Mm-hmm. That is another one that we did as teenagers. And then we've done through the years, not every year, but like every 5 or 6 years, we'll meander down there and go to Preservation Hall.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful thing. I think some of the simplistic things were really good. The lakefront always holds a special place. We used to walk the, like you can't do it anymore, but you used to be able to go out to the harbor and walk down and see all the boats. My husband loves boats. And so we'd walk and see all the boats.
And the West End
Harbor. We would take the kids to West End Park.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another really special. Mm-hmm. But the lakefront itself is a wonderful memory of taking y'all out there kite flying on the levee.
Yep.
You know, so I think that hits on what she's saying.
Yeah, like, it does. And again, when we talk to Richard Campanella next week, we're actually going to talk about the development of the lakefront and how that came to be, because all that land is reclaimed land.
It is. And there used to be a beach out there where you could go.
Yes.
It wasn't Pontchartrain Beach. It was, I don't know what it was.
There is a tiny sliver of a beach still there by Seabrook Bridge.
Yeah, but it's no longer manned with a lifeguard. And I don't know how they feel today about you swimming in a lake, whether, you know, there's.
Yeah. I debated the other day taking Sophia, and I thought, if I do it, I'm not going to be able to tell her mom. And we're good here because her mom doesn't listen to the podcast. But I debated, you know what? Maybe we should go try it. How bad can it be? I remember as a kid going in the lake and skiing a lot and always getting sick. But I think the lake is a lot better than it used to be.
Well, and of course, you don't know now with the dredging and all that went on at one time with that. So if you ever went out there, it would be mostly wading, you know, not getting way into it. And again, there are no longer lifeguards out there.
Right. Yeah, it's different.
But, you know, and then there are other memories, but they're all gone now, like Pontchartrain Beach and things like that.
So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually haven't done an episode on Pontchartrain Beach, and Brian Batt, sort of a local celebrity, wrote a book about Pontchartrain Beach because it was his family, the Batt family, that built Pontchartrain Beach. I need to get Brian on the show. All right, we have a lot of questions, so let's keep going.
Okay, we have
to hurry up. Eric Ruins, I hope I'm saying your name right, Eric. I'd be interested in your mom's most vivid memories about running the restaurant and how the business changed over time.
Well, first off, we were ignorant when we bought the restaurant. So how it changed over time is my husband became a whiz at how to manage the business and how to make it profitable for raising a family. So that's one enormous change. I think what changed was, I think the clientele we got, I think in the beginning, it was mostly very local, not just local New Orleans, but local to Gentilly. Uh-huh. And then over time, we got people from all over, which was a real blessing because we had people coming from Metairie, Chalmette, the West Bank, Slidell, lots and lots of visitors because very humbly, I'll say, we became known. Uh-huh. And so people sought us out. And so they were coming. So that meant we had a real big cross-section of people from the person who stayed at home and raised children, which was wonderful, to people who you would recognize and you'd recognize the names. We had a vast clientele. But it was that change, and that was really awesome. The other thing that changed in my own mind, it became a little bit more difficult to operate successfully without a lot of grief in the city. Yeah. I'm putting that very tactfully without getting into it. That became very difficult. You know, trying to do things the right way was a little tough at times, and we're going to leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
That became hard. And then I will say, toward the end, labor was an enormous problem. It got so that we were cutting hours to save our good staff from having to work the hours we were working.
Right, cutting the hours of the restaurant.
Yes, cutting the hours of the restaurant. Because we had a philosophy, you know, our two managers really need to have a life and they need to have income. So we took the brunt of that. So we worked the 60-hour work weeks and tried to keep them reasonable hours, still tough hours. And it just became hard. I don't know. I can't imagine now.
Right. I think it's so much worse now.
It's worse now. And it was really difficult then.
Yeah.
Now, you know, that was one big change we saw. It used to be we could hire high school kids and college kids for part-time jobs. And then it got to be they weren't available. And so then you try to find people that are available. It was just really hard. Mm-hmm. I would say that was a really tough thing.
Yeah.
The people we did get that stay with us were lovely and wonderful and hard workers, but it was hard to find those.
Yeah. And we had people
in the job we were in.
We had people that worked with us for decades, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There was a woman that worked for us that her grandson right now, as we're recording this, tonight is game three of the College World Series, and her grandson or
great-grandson
is playing for LSU, and she came with the restaurant. So my dad knew her when he worked there as a young teenager, and then she worked there for him and worked there so long that I grew up with her. I mean, she was much, much older than me. She babysat Pete Fountain, if you know that name, but she just came with the restaurant.
She did. And then there's one guy I've got to mention, Ramon, is like a second brother to Mark and a brother to our daughter, because Ramon was there 20 years until Katrina. And he still remains a very close personal family friend of all the kids and us. And so, yeah, that part of the business really changed because, you know, when you take over the business as a teenager, which we were, the workers are either very much older than you or the same age. Mm-hmm. So it took a lot of discipline to be able to not just be friendly, but be a nice boss. Then we moved into, we were older than all of them and could be the good boss, but be a boss. And, you know, and so then the people that came with us then have stayed. And that's just a really good thing. So that was a good change, but a change nonetheless.
Yep. So before we move on to questions from our Facebook group, Mom, I want to talk about our newest sponsor. They're called All the Bitter. So they make 100% alcohol-free bitters using organic ingredients. They're winners of 15 awards from major spirit competitions. They can be used in both alcohol-based and alcohol-free concoctions. I had promised them I would get you to try this, and I didn't, so we'll do it afterwards. But I've tried them in multiple drinks. I do drink alcohol, so I've had them in alcohol drinks. I've put them in lemonade. I've put them in water. But they are terrific on vanilla ice cream. And that's the part that I want you to try. So you put just a dropper or two of the flavor on vanilla ice cream. They have four main bitters now with several experimental varieties on the way. The ones I have are the New Orleans, which is inspired by Angostura and Peychaud's bitters, as well as orange, lavender, and one that they just call aromatic. Place your order at allthebitters.com and use code BBS15 to get 15% off your order. And since I forgot to do that, Mom, I'll do it afterwards. I think if Sophie hasn't eaten it all, we have some vanilla ice cream. Now we have some questions from our Facebook community.
Okay.
Mark Wingfield asks, and this is a little overlap, but we'll do it. What are a couple of your favorite aspects of raising children in New Orleans that people raising children elsewhere can't relate to or understand? And you kind of hit that earlier.
I did hit some of it, but there was one thought I had about that. It's like when our children were small, many of the cousins lived nearby. Many of the family did. And it was lovely because you want to throw a birthday party, you just call the cousins and they all show up and they became friendly. I miss that in today's world, that we don't have that culture of, not everybody, but a lot of people like the Bologna family don't have the culture of having family close by. And that was fun. Our kids got to spend every Wednesday evening with my mom and dad, mama and papa, because I'd take them over, Vince worked, for dinner. Friday nights, they kept the kids so that I could work. So they had a real relationship with their grandparents. And I think that's a wonderful aspect. But because so many people transfer around, like when these twins here were first born, they were up in Virginia. So had they not come home, they would not have been near the rest of the family. So I think that that's something that I really enjoyed, the availability of that for them to know, good, bad, or indifferent, to know everybody.
Sure.
You know, that was, so that's one aspect that was,
yeah,
was kind of missing.
Well, and that stuck. So I don't know that I've mentioned it on the show, but I just went with five cousins and their spouses, or four cousins and their spouses, plus Marie and I went to Sicily. So the Bolognas are from Alia, Sicily, and we just went. And it was very much like going with friends because we grew up together. So next up, Nazreen McDowell. Always interested in education, how schooling works then versus now. I think you covered that. It was largely, there was a parochial school system. There was a public school system that was very traditional.
And a private school system.
Right, and a private school system. Now there are fewer Catholic schools than there were. There is no New Orleans school board like there used to be. So if you go to public schools, you really are going to a charter school today. And we talked a little bit about that, about how it's very different. Next up is Michelle Minotti. How has it changed since you raised me to how my kids are experiencing New Orleans now?
Well,
I think we were more free range. You know, I think we were able at the age that our girls are now, we were riding our bikes to the girl, for instance.
I don't remember that, but I think you're right in that we felt a little freer, but it could be where we lived. I mean, we lived out more or less in the suburbs, if you will. So it was a little bit different. I think that was different. Certainly, I thought you were going to ask me how was it different from when I grew up, because by the time I was 11, I was taking the bus down to Canal Street and meeting friends on the bus route. We'd time it, and then we could go down there. Would I say that that would be kosher today? Nope, I would not say that. But, you know, but again, I mean, it's just a little bit different in that respect. I don't see a whole lot of difference. I mean, I see some differences. Like, yeah, Mark could ride his bike, you know, pretty far and do that kind of thing. These girls don't ride their bikes that far because there's busy streets around here and things like that, you know. So I don't know. That's a hard question because I think if we talk to my parents, they would think that we're grossly different than them and so on and so forth. And in reality, you're really not. It's because the things around you have changed somewhat.
Right. I think it's amusing that you refer to where we used to live as a suburb. It was 2 miles from the restaurant, and it's 4 miles from here. So it's not a suburb.
But it seems more like it is.
I understand. It's not. I was going to say it's not quite in the heart of the city, but that's not true either. It is just the fact that it felt suburban, but it was it was suburban in the sense if you consider the French Quarter the original New Orleans, which it is, then by those definitions, it would be suburban. But again, it was 5 miles from the French Quarter. All right, so this next question. So I'm just going to give the name of the person and the question, and you can explain who she is.
Okay.
Maurice Rawls asks, how are you, Mom, able to balance raising children, running a successful restaurant, and time for family? So first start off by explaining who Maurice Rawls is.
Maurice is my oldest sister, Mo, who's about 4 years older than I am. And funny she would ask that because at one point we were in business together and had to work with five children between us.
Next door to the restaurant.
Next door to the restaurant. But the answer to that is, and I know it'll sound hokey, but a lot of belief and faith in God that he would give me the strength, the power, the ability, and the wisdom to get through it. And some days were sketchy. I will say we had flexibility in our life in that if the kids were sick or the kids needed me, I stayed home. So we did have that. And then Vince would just work twice as hard. I also had the grace of having parents close by that, and the kids adored
my
parents.
We spent a lot of time with them.
They spent time with them. It's not that I dumped them over there every day, but when need be, they were there to pick up the slack and help out. So I think the way I was able to balance it, first off, you got to have strong support system, which I did with their dad. You know, he and I worked on everything together and could talk it through. Secondly, we had the support of family that could help us out. And I think that was it. And thank God we had kids who, they bucked, but not all the time. So that made it easy that they, each one enjoyed a different element of the business. And so, and then they understood. You know, when you have children born into a business, they grow up understanding this is the family dynamic.
Right. Yeah, there was no different. I mean, there wasn't much separation. Mm-mm. I think partly because you guys were young, but there was no separation between work and business. You know, it was at the dining room table. Often dinners were at the restaurant or, you know, even I can remember at one point the restaurant was closed on Sundays and we would still go pick up food after church and eat at the restaurant on Sundays. So there wasn't a lot of separation there. Next up is Francisco Wu. I'm going to read this and I'm going to make a comment before I let you comment. I believe it may be in the plans for some of us in the near future. How is being retired in New Orleans? So you get to answer that in a minute, but he then says, what does the city offer for the elderly? So the one thing I would point out is that my parents are very young. Mom and Dad are both 73. So I don't think that qualifies for elderly. And the older I get, the younger that seems. So 73 doesn't qualify for elderly. But what do you think about, and obviously you guys live across the lake, but what do you think about retirement in and or around New Orleans?
I would not see that as a bad thing because that's what we're doing. We're retired and live near New Orleans. Now, I will say the cost of living in New Orleans proper is high. So you would have to consider that from a financial standpoint. I would also say it's not so much applicable to us, but a lot of our friends concern themselves where they're going to live because of medical care. Well, obviously you have that in the city now. It's available. It's there. The other thing would be, how are you about the things you know that go on in the city? Like you're not going to get the streets fixed in orderly fashion, and you may have trouble with getting your garbage picked up and all of that. So, I mean, there are things to consider about daily life that you may want to think about. But in terms of being retired, oh no, there's wonderful things to do. There's plays, there's music, there's good restaurants, there's
Mardi
good
Gras,
medical care, there's Mardi Gras, there's French Quarter Fest. We just went to French Quarter Fest, and some of our friends said, you did what? I said, of course we went to French Quarter Fest. The hardest thing about French Quarter Fest, parking. It was high and it was far, but it was okay with us because we walk. But I think the ability to, once you retire, to volunteer for things. There are many opportunities here that would get you ingratiated or with other people immediately that you could do. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of church ministry. That's our thing. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of social organizations and things.
Sure.
I once volunteered for the art department on the North Shore when we were first moved over there. So I would think it's fine, but I would think it's comparative to any place you retire to that's not your home. Mm-hmm. You have to think about, what is it you want to do there? What do you want to accomplish? What do you want to be part of? And I think that's the key factors. What are your particular needs? Mm-hmm. You know, we knew what our needs were, was to be near to the city, to manage property, to be near to the city, to access all of its things. We wanted a little bit bigger piece of property and to be sort of in Mayberry, just kind mm-hmm. of a laid-back, really quiet place where there's not a lot of hustle and bustle. That was our needs. But in terms of retiring in New Orleans, I'd say go for it. I talked to somebody like Liz Woods, his friend. I talked to somebody like that and say, hey, we're thinking about it. What is it we really need to consider? Especially if you're coming from elsewhere. If you lived here and moved away and coming back, then you already know some of what
right.
you're looking for.
Yeah, it's totally why Liz Wood, who owns Liz Wood Realty, why she's a sponsor of the show. It's the number one question that I get in the Facebook group, and the number one question I get when people private message me is about coming to New Orleans, moving to New Orleans. New Orleans is a great place, as you hear my mom and I talking about, but it is complicated in terms of choosing where you live based on what your needs and expectations are. It's not easy in that regard, precisely because of what makes it unique and interesting, that it is so different and so unique in different parts of the city. And so I think that makes it a challenge. Sandy Lester Murray asks, how safe do you feel? I didn't catch this at first. Mm-hmm. How safe do you feel at your age in the city?
Well, at my age, I feel okay. But I think, I'm going to put a little asterisk with it, I think you have to be smart. And I think that's true of any place we go, my husband and I go to visit any town, any city, you have to be smart. Will we come to the city late at night? No, unless Mark and Marie needed us. We don't do that. You know, it's far to drive. It's dark. It's whatever. So I think you have to be smart. We go to restaurants with the kids. We go places. We do things. But we think we're smart about it. It's like if we're going to go down to the French Quarter, that's not our thing to begin with. Not Bourbon Street and all that, but maybe to go to a restaurant or something, we're going to do it during the day. I mean, it's real simple. We feel fine walking all over during the day. So I would say at my age, you know, I'm fine. And often I've had to come here by myself, you know, come
yeah,
to the city
sure.
for the kids or whatever, or go down to where they go to school. And I'm pretty good. But again, I would say that's only a fair question if you're going to apply it to every other mm-hmm. large city. And I know New Orleans is not large, but it's considered a major city.
Mm-hmm.
So I would think you'd have to apply that to any city. How safe do you feel going to Memphis downtown, or do you feel going to New York or
yeah,
San Diego or Los Angeles or wherever?
We lived right outside Washington, D.C. at the time. It was considered the murder capital of the United States, and it was fun. And we did go out at night, and we used public transportation, but we were smart about it.
You have to be smart, you know?
Yeah. So, okay. So this next one is a comment. And again, I'm going to read it and I'm going to read the person and I'll let you maybe, since it's a general comment, I'll let you give whatever story you want about this person. Eleanor Perrette says, I can't wait to hear Jan's answers to these questions. So you explain who Eleanor Perrette is and you can tell your own story about Eleanor Perrette since she introduced herself into the conversation.
Yeah. Eleanor Perrette is my husband's oldest sister.
And my godmother.
And Mark's godmother. And well, Ellie, as we call it, Ellie or Ella, lived out of town for so many years, I really didn't get to know her well because she and her husband were transferred quite a bit. So I didn't have an early relationship with her other than I kind of both admired her and was terrified of her because she seemed to have it all together when we were first married. I mean, I realize now she was as clueless as the rest of us, but it just seemed very impressive. So, but then as the years wore on, we became more friendly. And so Ella is a delight. We were just up there to visit him the other day. She has a different point of view than us sometimes, but that's really okay. We all get along that way.
And they live in Baton Rouge. And,
they do.
And like me, he worked, my Uncle Ken worked for the federal government, and they moved around quite a bit. And then when they retired, they came back to Louisiana. They came back to Baton Rouge. But Mom talked earlier about the big family events. We often had big family events there. I remember for years we had Easter at their house in Baton Rouge. Yeah. So, all right. Last question for you, Mom. This comes from Suzanne Mazzocca, who actually, she and her husband are sharing the season ticket, the Saints season tickets with me this year. So how did you feed and comfort the kids?
How did I feed and comfort them? Well, I was just sharing this with somebody else, and they thought this was incredible. When we were first married and had these three kids and had the business, we were on a really strict budget, super tight. So imagine I had to grocery shop for 6 weeks. So I take the kids, and they each were allowed to choose one special treat. It was a bag of cookies, a bag of, didn't matter. Once that was gone, then it was gone. And then they had to rely on Mom to provide simple treats. So one thing was we were on a budget, but I was adamant, because of my own childhood experience of not having this, we would all eat together every night. Now, that posed a huge problem since Vince had to work every night for the first 3 years of the business. Nonetheless, one parent was at the dinner table with the kids every single night. So the way I fed them was you figure out what to feed them and you budget it over 6 weeks and that's what you get. And they were pretty good about it. I mean, Mark didn't like tomatoes. He was allergic, so he couldn't eat that.
Still don't like tomatoes.
You know, one kid didn't like corn. But basically, we had a family meal. And I have to say, unlike a lot of things today, what I cooked is what you got, because I didn't have wherewithal to keep cooking 15 different things. So we did that. So that's how I fed them on a budget. And then as they grew older, they became very fond of stopping by Dad's restaurant to get something on the way home. And especially the youngest one would drive our daughter nuts because he'd always get the most expensive thing. Right. And so she didn't want him to eat it. And so that's how they were fed. They were, you know, they always had a family meal. I think that's a good memory for them. And yeah. I mean, nothing super special.
So that's the end of our questions. Huh. It's taken 7 years to get here. So is there anything else you want to say while you have the microphone?
That I was delighted that he thought it was worthwhile to do an interview with his mom. And I'm very humbled by that. I also am thrilled what he's bringing to New Orleans, because it so reminds me of my mother's passion. And that I just always have thought was an inspiration for him, because although she passed very young, she just was a diehard that people understand we're not Bourbon Street. We're not the guy hanging off the pole. We're history. We're culture. We're all those things. So I'd want to know that. And I want people to know, don't be afraid to enjoy New Orleans. Just be smart about it. And don't be afraid to bring your kids. We're not full of the things you see advertised that get flash. You know, Mardi Gras is for families. City Park is for families. Just going to different things here, don't be afraid of that. Be smart about it. And I'm thrilled to have two granddaughters here to pass that on. And a daughter-in-law who's lovely. She's really fun. So I would say that. And I just want to thank him. And may God bless his future endeavors.
So, Mom, thanks for doing this. Thanks also to everyone who submitted a question. And with that, we're going to turn it over to your granddaughters to close us out.
New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you do.
Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.